Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by Careful Clean, serving the Bay Area with exterior cleaning services, pressure washing, solar panel cleaning, and wood restoration services for residential and commercial clients. Careful-clean.com.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, Governor Jerry Brown going all out to shake up the funding formula for public schools.
Increasingly, the state is turning into a two-tier society. Those at the top are doing better and better, and those at the middle and at the bottom are doing worse and worse.
Meanwhile, in the Central Valley, how a thirst for water is causing farmland to sink. In San Francisco, two new plays portray life in the shadows for undocumented immigrants. And in Santa Barbara, a high school art exhibit inspired by students' grandparents.
I would love to see this in a lot of towns because it's just a good, good situation. You know, it's good for the kids, it's good for the families, and they'll go on some grandparents' wall as soon as this show goes down.
It's the California Report. Well, Governor Brown this week threw down the gauntlet, warning critics of his plan to overhaul K-12 school funding formulas to stay out of his way.
If people are going to fight it, they're going to get the battle of their lives, because I'm not going to give up until the last hour. And I'm going to fight it with everything I have, and whatever we have to bring to bear in this battle, we're bringing it.
I don't know if it was all that hot and sour soup he had on his recent trip to China or what, but Brown was unusually feisty. Joining us now to talk about the governor's plan to shake up education funding is our Sacramento Bureau Chief, Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Scott. How you doing?
I'm well. So boil it all down for us, if you would. What are some of the key elements of Jerry Brown's proposal?
Like all things state funding and education related, this gets very complicated very quickly, but we can divide this into two big camps. First of all, Governor Brown wants to take all of these what's called categorical grants. These are specific amounts of money that the state gives to school districts to do things like physical education, like teacher training, like safety, things like that. He wants to squish those all down into one big grant that the state gives to school districts, saying you can still spend money on all of these things, but local school districts, you decide how you spend your money. We're not going to give you specific requirements. By and large, that's something everybody seems to agree on. The other part of this is where you start to see the divisions. Brown wants to essentially give more money to school districts that have more poor students and more students that are trying to learn English. And he'd do that by taking the money that the state gives to school districts and dividing it into three pots. First, there's a basic amount of money that every school district would get for each student. Depending on the age range of the student, it's between $6,000 to $8,000 per student. Then Brown wants to take what's called a supplemental grant. And for every student who's poor, and they define that by saying students who are eligible for supplemented meals, things like that, and for every student who's an English language learner, the school district would get a chunk of that grant, about 35% of the initial grant they're getting.
You know, helping poor kids, English learners, that seems like something Democrats would agree on, and they have a supermajority in both the Assembly and the Senate, but they're not unanimous on this issue. So how are the politics shaking out?
That's right. The Senate Democrats say they're on board with giving more money to school districts that have more poor students. It's just the details that get complicated, and it really all centers around this third chunk of money, which is called a concentrated grant. And that's an idea where Governor Brown says, look, if you're a school district where more than half of your students are either poor or trying to learn English, I want to give you a third round of money. This is about $2 to $3 billion of money we're talking about. And that's where Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, he's the top Democrat in the Senate, disagrees.
We are concerned about the same kids he's concerned about. Under his formula, there are thousands of kids that remain invisible. Because if you're a poor kid in one of those districts that isn't in that 50% category, they're not getting the additional money.
So, Scott Detrow, how is Steinberg's plan, the Senate Dems' plan, different from Jerry Brown's?
He wants to take that third pot of money, that so-called concentration grant, and spread it around to every school district and basically increase the initial grant that the state is giving to them. Governor Brown has big problems with that, as you heard from that soundbite. He got very angry, saying he's going to fight that. He's going to give them, you know, the battle of their lives. And Brown's argument is that, you know, in state budgetees, $2 to $3 billion really isn't that much money. He says it gets more bang for its buck by concentrating on these poor districts as opposed to spreading it around throughout the state.
So let's talk about winners and losers. We're not talking about a lot more money, as you said. So who would get more? Who would be the big beneficiaries of the governor's plan?
This is where the politics start to get interesting, because urban school districts and rural school districts with more poor students come out as big winners in Governor Brown's plan. And the losers are the suburbs, high-income areas, school districts that have wealthier students, higher property values. And they don't get less money than they would before. They would receive kind of baseline money. But their problem is this. They're saying, look, for years and years now, through these bad budget years, we've lost money from the state. This is a year where we're getting more revenue for the first time in a long time, and this plan kind of leaves us behind. One school district like that is Ocalanis Union in Contra Costa County. Associate Superintendent Christopher Learned says this really puts them in a bind.
In a district like ours, the dollars that are going to be restored are coming back so slowly that, you know, even though people are under the belief that Prop 30 passed, so we're saved financially in this district, we're not. We're going to have to be cutting.
And there's no issue where the politics are more local and more emotional than education. This is something where parents take a look and say, wait a second, my kids' schools are important. We're getting less money here. We don't like this idea. And they might start pressuring legislators, and that could lead to some interesting outcomes here.
Well, and that brings up the question, where is the public on this? Do we have any sense?
Yeah, the Public Policy Institute of California took a look at this just last week, and they found overwhelming support for Governor Brown's idea of directing more money to poor school districts. Something like 70% of respondents to that poll said that they were on board with that plan. That number fell a little bit when they asked the question in the way of, well, if they get more money but other school districts get less money, are you still okay with it? But still, between 50 and 60% of respondents said, even when you put it that way, yeah, this is a good idea.
And Scott, finally, all of this is part of the governor's budget. The May revision of that budget is coming out. What happens next? How is this going to unfold?
Tax revenue is coming in pretty well in California, especially compared to the last few years. Right now, people are projecting the state's going to get something like $4 billion more dollars than they were all planning on. We're in kind of a holding pattern for another couple of weeks here, but then this will really heat up because Governor Brown is saying he wants this done with the budget, which means a final plan needs to be in place by June 15th. And the Senate Democrats are saying, well, maybe that can happen, but we really want to take our time here. And if this bleeds into the fall, if this bleeds into next year, that's okay with us, too.
First big battle between the governor and his Democratic allies. Going to be interesting to see how it all shakes out. Sacramento Bureau Chief Scott Detrow. Scott, thanks so much.
Anytime.
Relationships between grandparents and their grandchildren are unique, significant, and often fleeting. An art exhibit, now on display in Santa Barbara, aims to strengthen and preserve those bonds. The Grandparent Portrait Show features drawings, paintings, sculptures, and photographs of grandparents by local junior high and high school artists. Reporter Diane Bach checked out the show and brings us this story.
Successful art openings always generate a certain amount of buzz. Tonight, there's an extra palpable layer of energy in downtown's Faulkner Gallery. The room is packed. Students, teachers, family, and friends have gathered for their first look at some very special, one-of-a-kind pieces of art. Smiles and hugs abound, along with a few tears.
I get moved by these things. And the kids, what they do to create and capture, it's awesome.
That's Monica Coons. She's looking at a striking charcoal portrait of a 50s-era young woman wearing pearls around her neck, a hat perched on an elegant hairstyle. The portrait was drawn by her daughter, Jacqueline Hewitt.
It's a picture of my mom's mom, and she passed away, so I wanted to do something with her.
It's a picture of her from when my mom was young. So to see my mom up there, you know, it's just very touching, and it just reminds me.
To see the reactions of grandparents and parents It's extraordinary, really.
John Houchin is Jacqueline's eighth grade honors art teacher.
It's not something that art teachers get to see very often. It's a connection, a human connection between the students and their work. And it's been phenomenal.
The Grandparent Portrait Show is sponsored by Santa Barbara Student Art Fund, which was established in 2006 by a group of retired art teachers. The fund supports art programs in the area's public junior high and high schools. This exhibit is their signature event.
This is the way that we are known in the community.
Sally Hamilton's a member of the fund.
3- and 4-generation families coming here, they're all so proud of it, and it just links them in a wonderful way.
I just hope somebody hears this and copies it.
Grandparent portraits were a regular part of Audie Love's high school class curriculum. And when he heard that a grandparent's portrait had been displayed at a memorial service, Love had his aha moment. He created the Grandparent Show 4 years ago.
I would love to see this in a lot of towns because it's just a good situation. You know, it's good for the kids, it's good for the families, and they'll go on some grandparents' wall as soon as this show goes down.
Globetrotting grandparents inspired high school senior Olivia Sturman's work.
They've been to China, and here's a picture of them in London.
Olivia's whimsical piece is titled 83 Years of Travel. It contains vintage postcards, a map, and a miniature jet airplane, along with photographs of her grandparents, Adrian and George Sturman.
She stole a couple of our albums and cut out these pictures. I didn't notice them missing until now.
I was surprised. Yeah, I'm absolutely amazed. This is a 3-dimensional, which is very interesting. Shows a lot of talent.
Their granddaughter beams.
They're really quite inspirational. I love my grandparents.
And that love is very evident in the Faulkner Gallery, where the Grandparent Portrait Show runs through April 30th. For the California Report, I'm Diane Bach in Santa Barbara.
And you can see some of those portraits. We've got them on our website, californiareport.org. When the California snowpack is measured next week, we'll have a better sense of what the summer water supply will be. It could leave farmers scrambling for water, potentially pumping more precious groundwater from aquifers. But too much pumping has overdrawn some aquifers, causing the land to sink in parts of California's farm belt. As the California Report's Central Valley Bureau Chief Sasha Coca explains, some farmers are looking at a unique solution.
A meadowlark sings on a telephone pole, perched high above rows of gnarled grapevines. We're in rural Madera County, about 45 minutes northwest of Fresno. But there's another way to get a bird's-eye view of these vineyards. Reggie Hill unlocks a metal gate that opens onto the levees, rising more than 12 feet above the fields and orchards here.
Watch out for holes here. There's a lot of rodents out here.
Hill is in charge of 191 miles of levees along the lower San Joaquin River, which can flood in big snowmelt years. Federal and state officials check to make sure these berms are high enough to protect crops, farmhouses, and schools.
They came out here, did a survey.
But over the last few years, Hill says, something strange has started to happen.
And then the next time they came out to finish up their survey, none of their elevations matched. So it took them a while to figure out, well, it isn't that we made a mistake. The land is changing.
Measurements show the land here is sinking about a foot a year as thirsty cities and farms pump water from aquifers deep underground.
The more demand for water, the deeper they're starting to chase the water. Initially, the wells out here were, you know, not 300 feet deep, but now you have some in here that are approaching 900 feet deep. They're just chasing water.
Water that's often hidden below a thick layer of clay.
And what happens is they start pulling water out from underneath some of these clay layers, and these clay layers collapse, and it can't come back.
That rapid sinking, called subsidence, is some of the fastest ever measured in the United States. Michelle Sneed, a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, says that's a problem.
A foot a year is quite fast and hard to engineer against for things like bridges and dams and roadways.
But what if there was a way to keep the Central Valley's taxed underground aquifers from drying up and the land from sinking? About an hour's drive south of our levee lies the huge Fresno County farm known as Terra Nova Ranch. Powerful electric pumps draw well water for about 7,000 acres of crops, like tomatoes, grapes, almonds, and pistachios. Manager Don Cameron says his electric bill tops $1 million a year, in large part because those pumps have to work so hard to pull groundwater from wells hundreds of feet deep.
Out here, we've seen declining water table levels over the last 30 years that I've been here.
Terra Nova Ranch sits in the Kings River Basin, an area where farmers are pumping unsustainable volumes of water in dry years. At the other extreme, farms and communities here risk floods when rivers are pulsing with too much water. Terra Nova is experimenting with a way to address both problems. The idea is to capture excess river water in the occasional big water years, diverting it directly into crop fields, where the water will sink into the ground and recharge the aquifer.
We're putting it away when there is flood water available and essentially storing it underground rather than building a new dam somewhere, which is pretty unlikely in this day and age.
This is a little different from conventional groundwater banks, where farmers share water from an underground aquifer or buy it from each other. Instead, this is an experiment in banking water right on the farm where it will be used.
There have been a lot of growers that have looked at our operation with skepticism.
2 years ago, Don Cameron worked with environmental engineers and state regulators to flood hundreds of acres of farmland with up to a foot of water from the Kings River. The water pooled up in the fields, making vineyards look like rice paddies, and that raised a few eyebrows around here.
We had grapes underwater for 3 months. The vines eventually turned yellow color, and we turned the water off, and about a week later they were back to normal.
And they still produced grapes, with excess river water that otherwise would have flowed out to the San Francisco Bay. But there's a catch. The strategy might not work everywhere.
It could backfire.
Hydrologist Michelle Sneed says deep under some farms in the San Joaquin Valley, there are huge swaths of what's called Corcoran clay. And if you put water on top of that, it could make things worse.
It really depends on the geology of the area, whether that is a good solution or not.
Because if water flooding into the fields can't penetrate through the dense Corcoran clay, it can't recharge the deepest aquifers where farmers are pumping the most. And the weight of the water pushing down on that clay layer could make the land sink even faster. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
California isn't usually a magnet for promising jazz talent. In fact, the flow of musicians often runs from west to east, as Chicago, Boston, and New York siphon off promising players from the left coast. But in recent years, the University of California has helped reverse that flow by recruiting heavyweight improvisers as faculty, like flutist Nicole Mitchell. The California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert reviews a new album by the UC Irvine Professor of Music.
Jazz hadn't produced a major new flute player in more than a decade when Nicole Mitchell emerged as a creative force in the 1990s. Born in upstate New York and raised in Southern California, she spent the last two decades in Chicago. Adopting the expansive aesthetic summed up by the Art Ensemble of Chicago as great black music, ancient to the future, she embraced jazz's continuum from blues, swing, and bebop to Eastern modes, African polyrhythms, and beyond. Hear many of those influences at play on her new album, Aquarius, the debut release by her quartet, Ice Crystal. The Chicago combo features vibraphonist Jason Adashevitz, bassist Joshua Abrams, and drummer Frank Rosalie. As the band's name implies, the instrumentation lends itself to a translucent, elemental sonic palette that's striking in its purity. composed all 10 pieces on the album, and her melodies slip and slide. Exploring the contrasting sonorities between her brightly aqueous flute and Adashevitz's metallic vibes, her tunes often evoke particular scenes or sensations, like the steady upward motion of Above the Sky. Mitchell spends a lot of time in the flute's piping upper register, a brittle space that can wear out its welcome. I prefer when she dips down, employing the husky tone that reveals the breath behind her sound. While Adashevitz's vibes define the album's sonic parameters, the album's soul runs through bassist Joshua Abrams, heard here in the third melodic section of Yearning. Position at UC Irvine brought Mitchell back to Southern California in 2011, but she's still strongly associated with Chicago. She closes the album with Fred Anderson, a tribute to one of her most important mentors, the brusque and expressive tenor saxophonist who embodied the Second City ethic of creative independence and community engagement. Mitchell has carried that Chicago spirit back home, and the cool beauty and crystalline textures of Aquarius offer Californians a memorable introduction to this singular artist.
Andrew Gilbert is a Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed Aquarius by Nicole Mitchell's Ice Crystal. The debate over immigration reform is building in Congress, and it's being watched closely here in California, home to some 3 million undocumented immigrants. And just as though they'd planned it, two San Francisco theaters are staging new plays, telling the stories of two undocumented immigrants and the challenges they face living outside the law. KQED's Cy Musiker talked to the playwrights about their work and their message to lawmakers.
Meet Luis and Guang. Luis is from Mexico, Guang from China, but they have a lot in common. They're both physically trapped, Luis by a brush fire in a cave in the play The River. Guang is stuck on a broken elevator in the musical Stuck Elevator. And both men have entered the U.S. illegally.
He's an anonymous immigrant man, faceless, voiceless. That part of humanity which we have most vilified after the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Playwright Richard Montoya makes Luis's story the heart of his play, The River, even though Luis appears only as a ghost or in flashbacks. The heat and smoke from the brush fire have killed him, something that really happened to a number of immigrants in eastern San Diego County in 2007.
I will return to you, my love.
He uses the more formal you.
As the river opens, two hipsters from San Francisco have found Luis's body, and they're reading his final letter to his wife in Matamoros.
I'm looking for the river in the land of big fire. No me gusta.
So for Montoya, immigration is like the trials of purgatory, with citizenship waiting in heaven. In the musical Stuck Elevator, the metaphor for immigration is an elevator.
We have the idea that America is an elevator, you know, that you will be elevated.
Librettist Aaron Jafaris.
That idea is something that drives so many people to come here, and the reality is so much different, and so often people do get stuck.
Guang is literally stuck. He delivers takeout Chinese food in New York, but one day his elevator stops between floors for 81 hours, something that really happened to an undocumented Chinese delivery man in 2005.
The guard cannot know that I am here. He'll ask me for my papers. could see my name, then send me back to China.
Guang is afraid to press the intercom and call for help, Jafaris says, for fear the police will discover his immigration status.
That's part of his plight, because deportation would be the worst thing that could happen next to death.
The worst thing, because Guang, played by Julius Ahn, won't be able to support his son and wife Ming back in China.
She'll cry because she knows, and each tear a mirror repeating my new name, which will be shame.
So with an immigration reform bill in the U.S. Senate, I asked these artists if their plays offer any lessons for lawmakers. Stuck elevator composer Byron O. Young says he's more interested in how theater can stir a thoughtful discussion for the audience.
And not be yelling at each other, but rather maybe, you know, come to an understanding with each other. And hopefully that will carry to the lawmakers, because I feel that, you know, dividing the country is actually not the point.
Still, Stuck Elevator taps into one of America's master narratives, that we're a nation built by immigrants. One of Guang's undocumented co-workers tells him immigrant is the opposite of impossible. Mixing politics and theater is old hat for the River playwright Richard Montoya. As a member of the L.A. theater troupe Culture Clash, he specializes in social satire about the California melting pot. Montoya says he worries the Senate bill's tough standards will leave some immigrants still stuck in a legal limbo.
For those that can cross every one of those hurdles, you know, things will be fine. And for those that can't, they go further and further into the shadows. And in the shadows is where we find our Luis.
The last line in The River offers another way to think about the immigration debate. It's an old Mexican saying, that which you cannot drink or carry, leave in the river. A line Montoya explains this way.
When my dad and his generation ate around the family kitchen table, you didn't take a whole tortilla. You took a tortilla, split it in half, and you left the half. And to this day, I have that same habit. I'm in a restaurant, and I'll just, even if I'm eating alone, I'll rip it in half. And it comes from that idea of leave half behind for someone else.
The saying defines the difference, Montoya says, between those who think immigrants take American jobs and benefits without giving anything in return, and those who think immigrants enrich a U.S. where there's more than enough to go around. For the California Report, I'm Cy Musiker.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Thanks, as always, to our interns, Guy Marzorati and Gina Shalaba. Our editorial team includes Craig Miller, Victoria Malleone, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995, and the California Endowment. Health happens with prevention at calendow.org.